Hi friends, this is Henrik Palmgren and you are listening to Red Ice Creations Radio. Nice to have you with us. Thank you for tuning in to the program. We are here every Sunday and Thursday recording a new program from the west coast of Sweden. Take a look at our website, redicecreations.com. News updates, radio archive, forum, subscriber section, and a lot of resources and links to interesting and important research, videos, reports, and the news from around the world and beyond. And this is our Thursday program. We are moving straight towards September, and there's no turning back now. We're moving into autumn. Hope you all had a good week so far, and I'm glad that you're here today because we have our good friend Jake Kotze back on the program. Jake have been out on excursion abroad for some new new inspiration, visiting friends and hunting crop circles. And we're going to talk a little bit about Jake's recent trip to the UK and if he has had any luck with getting to any circles over there. And we'll also, of course, talk a little bit about Jake's most recent work. For all of you that don't know, Jake's website is thebravenewworldorder.blogspot.com. And you need to get over there right away and take a look at Jake's video material and articles in case you aren't familiar with any of Jake's work by now. Excellent and interesting and fascinating stuff by Jake. So let's bring on Jake and say hello. Hi, my friend. Thank you for coming on. It's great to have you back.
Hi, Henrik. Great to be here.
You know, is it good to be back home in Canada after a recent visit over in the UK?
It's very great to be back. It was a lot of fun. The crop circles was only like the first small part of my trip. I did some other activities as well, so some other friends. It was a really fun time, but the crop circles was about 5 days I spent in Wiltshire with Ben Fairhall, sort of hunting them down and getting a feel for what it's like to actually be in them instead of just viewing them on a screen.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting. Yeah.
Nice. So yeah, exactly. You went over there, and how long were you over there in total?
I was there for about 17 days, 2.5 weeks in the UK.
Sheesh.
And only about five of that looking at crop circles.
Right, and in Wiltshire, is that far from London, or?
It's about 1.5, 2 hours drive outside of London, so it was quite a lot of traveling. We had to drive in and out every day
go
back to where we were staying, and a lot of traveling, but well worth it. And the crop circles are pretty concentrated, surprisingly, more than I had thought.
Mm-hmm.
They happen in the same area. I mean, They're relatively close to each other, and they tend to congregate, as you know, a lot of people would know, mm-hmm. around the sacred sites there, you know, Silbury Hill and Avebury Henge and Stonehenge and those areas. It's, mm-hmm. So you don't really, surprisingly, have to travel that far to see them, which could either add, you know, some sort of suspicion in your mind that, okay, people are making them and they're just keeping it all near to the tourist routes as well.
Yeah.
Or it could explain something to you in sort of a ley line energy grid way that, you know, this is where the energies are concentrated. It'll depend on your take, really.
That's right. Did you get any chance to get to Stonehenge itself?
Yes, I did get to see Stonehenge twice, once just sort of driving by because it's surrounded by all these highways, which is, you know, another interesting thing to ponder, why we're surrounding all these sacred sites with these highways. You know, you got things built up almost to the edge of the Sphinx. You got Walmart encroaching on the pyramids in Mexico. It's, you know, is there a mystical reason for why we do these things? You know, are we unconsciously trying to, destroy the sacred or threaten it, or is it symbolic, or is it just, you know, we're trying to make a few bucks by having all these things near these sacred sites? So
yeah,
I don't know.
Exactly.
You know, interesting things to think about.
A Walmart close by, you know, always in hand.
Yeah, you can stand on one of these pyramids, I don't know which one, and apparently you can see the Walmart from the top of the pyramid.
Really? Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Okay. And somebody was telling me something about a KFC near the Sphinx. I'm not sure about that one, but it sounds believable. They'll one day paint, you know, Coca-Cola over the pyramids yet, you know. You give them some time.
Yeah, exactly. Coca-Cola, wasn't it Coca-Cola that had plans to display some kind of laser thing on the moon. I don't know how that's going.
I've heard such rumors, but I'd have no idea. It wouldn't surprise me too much, even though it's crazy outlandish. But sure. It makes sense in a symbolic sort of way. You know, materialism and rationalism, you know, trying to threaten all these symbols of the divine.
That's right. Talk about ad pollution, you know. Sheesh.
Yeah.
So, and by the way, I think some part, I think it was Stonehenge, some part of it actually was, because it's a big area, I guess, and there are, you know, beyond the stone circle itself, there's connecting stuff all around, and smaller circles and stuff like this, and I think even a parking lot were actually placed on top of one of these, I think.
I believe you're correct, yes. I read something like that in the guidebook. They dug stuff up underneath the parking lot, you know, and then they put it back up there. So yeah, there's all this stuff, yeah.
Exactly. And we have, I think in Ireland, you know, they're destroying, actually running a highway through, I don't know, remember exactly what ancient site it is now, but they're actually running it through the entire area, and the highway goes like pinpointing all the locations where it's at, you know.
Yes, I heard something about that as well. And it just all goes into this pattern of, you know, us sort of trying to threaten the divine and everything that points towards the mystical. We sort of want to surround it with our westernized materialist dogma, and sort of it's physically expressing itself by building highways around these sacred sites and Walmart and all this stuff, sort of trying to show the mystery what we think of it, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It might be upsetting, as you say, if there is a ley line connection running through a highway, and I mean that could break the grid maybe in a way, or disturb it, you know, who knows what the effects might be, you know.
Overall I wouldn't worry, because you can't destroy the mystery. You can sort of try, but you can't, you know. If you blow up the entire planet, it'll still be there. Even if you destroy the entire galaxy, it'll still be there. So good luck to them, you know.
I totally agree. Being over there in late summer, I guess this is a perfect time for crop circles. Is there anyone that you visited that you remember what date it was from, or what is it's called or something like that? Have you been able to pinpoint afterwards?
Well, there's a few that I found pretty significant. The last one we saw was the one that was at the PUC White Horse, and it was sort of a Mayan type. It had a Mayan type edge to it, and then sort of a sun in the middle with a triangle. I don't know if you know the one that I mean.
Do you know when this was created or laid down?
I'm bad with dates. I could sort of try and check with the one eye here while I'm talking to you. There was another one at Sugar Hill, which was fascinating. It had all these cubes forming a hexagram in the middle, and that one was August. I can't see the dates here. The PUC White Horse one was the 4th of August. That's the one that I was just talking about, the sort of Mayan sun disk type glyph.
Right,
I'm sort of 4th of August.
Do you find these at Crop Circle Connector? Or
Connector, that's right.
Okay,
yeah.
Let's see here, August. Yeah, here we are. Exactly. So this is nice. What's the sense of it? Is there anything special with the circles itself? Is there any energy involved here? What is your sense of it?
Well, my sense of it is, well, it's very interesting. It's the same when it comes to the movies that I look for synchronicities in, you know, and people are, this is probably the thing that comes up the most, and it is the most relevant question. You know, are people putting these there on purpose, you know, or is that some sort of mysterious force that is causing there to be these synchronicities, you know?
Yeah.
And obviously, I think both happen, but overall, it's the synchronicity itself. That doesn't matter who put it there or why it put it there. The fact that it's there is what's interesting. And the crop circles, in my mind, are very similar. There's a lot of evidence for it being some sort of mystery, you know? A lot of evidence. But there's also evidence for it being people. So it sort of depends on how you approach it.
Mm-hmm.
And but either way, for somebody who's into synchromysticism, the symbols are there. They're in the crop now. And I can totally see the scenario where the mystical force that's, you know, the eternal now that's always present works through whoever is, you know, trying to prank you there in the crops. A synchronicity is a synchronicity, whether it's intentional or not.
That's right.
I think some people find that a disappointing sort of point of view, because they want, you know, UFOs or aliens, and that is not excluded by my opinion, you know. I don't see it absolutely necessary. I think people could still make these things, and they would still be a perfectly valid place to look for synchronicities.
Yeah. Hmm. So did you get any chance to see, like, if you got down and looked at how the crop was laid, is it like very weaving patterns to it and swirling? And I mean, after seeing something like that, are you any wiser on how this actually might be done, created, or laid down, you know?
No, well, the only ones that I got in that were fresh was sort of the sugary heel one. It was about 2 days old.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know the one that I mean. It's about, I think it's like 18 cubes that are surrounding the central element that's sort of a David star.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
mm-hmm.
got this radiating sun all around it, sort of a big circular crop circle. And that particular one I was in about 2 days after it was formed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you must remember, when these things, you know, hit the deck, people just descend upon them and walk all over them. So
even
when they're on the crop circle connector site, you know, they've already been visited by the professionals in the field.
Mm-hmm.
Because if people found out about it immediately, they would just go stamp over all the evidence. So you couldn't check for the bent nodes and, you know, all the sort of energies and stuff like that, you know.
Oh, okay.
So they get in there before everybody.
Oh, okay.
Which makes sense. And whenever we get there, the general public, it's already been walked on, you know. So the fields have been broken, sort of been stamped on, and depending on the age, but 2 days you can still get a pretty good feel for just how beautiful, you know, the lay is inside.
Yeah.
And yeah, some of them display this really fascinating sort of, you know, weave-like motion, sort of like water moving through the circles, like making this shape. It looks like it's sort of liquidy.
Hmm.
And but the one that I was really excited about, because it had happened the previous evening, and we were in the fields looking for circles, and we got a tip-off at the Silent Circle Cafe, which is this place where people congregate and share information about crop circles.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd heard about one that had happened just the previous evening. It wasn't even up on the net yet. And this was the one at the PUC White Horse, happened about the 4th of August.
Mm-hmm.
And we went down there. And then as we arrived, it was beautiful because you could see it from the hillside, brand new crop circle. People were inside. But then as we sort of near, the farmers started chasing everybody out. So this
really?
Perfectly fresh crop circle I couldn't get into, unfortunately.
Oh, sheesh. Okay, so were there, it was like he was angry and calling the cops for stuff, or what happened there? I mean,
That particular one, the farmer had literally called the police, and the police showed up to make sure that nobody goes into, you know, their property, you know?
Sure, sure.
So it's pretty sad to think that, you know, if this is some kind of a mystical you know, communication, that it's the property of, you know, the farmer, and that the police can tell you not to go into this, you know, this mystery, to go explore this mystery.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, I'm looking at a few different ones here that are most recent from late August. And I'm looking at one here with a cuboid. It's eight of them. Which connect with the octagon again, and then it's cuboids.
That was the most recent one. Yeah.
It was? Okay, yeah, because I think
That one happened already while I was back in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just started thinking about this one because, yeah, this has now got the cuboid and then the octagonal sort of geometry and the eightfold geometry, and which is very interesting because, you know, I'm also very interested in octagons. And
yeah.
What was very interesting about the experience was the synchronicity of going down there. And then in this season that I got to go down there, it sort of seemed to be interacting with my work. I was I bet you this experience is shared by many people because, you know, depending on what who you are and what you're bringing, it'll interact differently with your experiences. But for me, it was recently I'd been making a video called The Cuboid Stargate, and I'd made one or two where I focused very heavily on the hexagons because of Saturn and this giant hexagon that's rotating on the North Pole of Saturn. And here they were sort of combined in this in the fields. There were one or two that actually had these cuboids and the hexagon. And yeah, then just most recently the octagon came in as well. So
that's interesting because I heard, I think it was Nancy Talbot, she's a researcher from a website called BLT Research, and she's been into crop circles for a long time. It was actually a long time since I heard from her on like a radio show or something, but she talked about this a lot, actually, about being able to influence in some way. Others do too, of course, but that they in some way, you know, bring the energy to the place, and because of that they can actually communicate, or almost like if they focus on a pattern, this is something that they can see an expression of in you know, the in the crop circles that are laid down after those persons have visited the place. And so this is interesting, actually, that the most recent one kind of connects with you and your work in a way.
the one that I actually got to go in, that that was the freshest, that, you know, the 5-day window that I had specifically connected to or had the shapes that I had been discussing very recently in my work.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the synchronicities were definitely there. So it was a pretty interesting experience.
Yeah. Very nice.
So, yeah, I mean, that element is definitely there. You don't know if you're tapping into something which is there or whether you're influencing it or which way around it's happening. You know, who knows? You know, depends on how you want to look at it.
That's
but
right.
Another interesting thing about that, we met a guy at that same Sugar Hill cuboid Stargate-ish crop circle, and he's an Indian guru, and he makes these YouTube videos, and you can actually, if you go to that that giant crop circle, beautiful one that happened on 777 this year. If you're familiar with that one, really large circle, like one of the biggest one in years.
Was this with the checkerboard? No, that was earlier.
No, that was the West Kinnett long barrel one.
Okay, yeah. Let's see.
Yeah, this was like a giant ohm shape. You know the Buddhist ohm?
Sure, yeah.
And sort of also like a little man, you know, there were a few ways that people had interpreted its design. It was just a very odd shape, but it was huge. And there's a lot of controversy about this one because there were two different teams videotaping that field that same evening.
Mm-hmm.
Why? I have no idea.
Really?
But there's actually infrared footage of this field, like hours during the supposed, you know, event, and there's no heat of people's bodies moving in the fields, and people have already got DVDs out about this, and and this Indian guru fellow that I was talking about, I'll try and pronounce his name, Prashant Trivedi. he has a video on YouTube that people can see if they go to the crop circle connector, and they go to the 777 ohm and scroll to the right at the end of the second page. You can see this guy's video where he's like shows that he did a meditation session before the crop circle happened, where they're going om om, and then and then a few days later, this giant om shape appears, and then he's got his guitar and he's playing his rock and roll ad lib songs next to the circle. It's hilarious.
I have it here. I'm going to link that up in connection with this show so people can take a look at that. Awesome.
Yes. Yes, so we met this guy. He was a fascinating character.
He's just
I don't know, some sort of guru, rock and roll, sacred site visiting mystic. It was really weird. But,
nice. Were there a lot of people around generally, or a lot of interest in this? I mean,
yeah. Like if you go to the circles and they're new, there's always activity, and the newer, the more people. And at this Silent Circle Cafe. There's always a bunch of tourists and just interested people, or croppies, as they're called, you know, people researching the field, people that you recognize from the DVDs you've watched about this stuff, just hanging around there, sharing tips, explaining to each other on maps how to get to these circles.
Nice.
Most of them, the majority of them, are really easy to get to. You know, they're just off the beaten path. Like when we went to Avebury Henge, there was one just next to the henge, and it's like it's made either by the force or by the people who are making them, so that you can easily access them or see them from a nearby hill or something like that. Like, it's made easy for you. But there were exceptions. Like, there was this beautiful pentagonal starburst one that we just couldn't find, no matter how hard we looked, and we spent hours looking for this damn thing. But it was a nice experience as well, just trying to find this circle.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Seeing that it can actually be difficult. Yeah.
Very nice. So did you spend some nice time in the big city of London also, or even the city of London? Did you tour anything around there?
I spent 2 days in London. Just went there because I'd been there before in 2001. London is actually where I was when 9/11 happened. You know.
Oh, really?
I was in London at that point in my life for 6 months, and it's right in the middle of my stay there. So it's sort of an interesting, eerie place because it was an important part of my life as well. And then this, you know, thing happened that's influenced my work and my existence quite heavily. This thing that happened in New York, and so yeah, seeing London is always interesting. And I was walking through Hyde Park and saw the new, like, Princess Diana Memorial Fountain. That was pretty interesting.
Really? This is not is this the one with the because they have one, I think, with a torch on it and a like eternal light. Is this the same one?
Yeah. I think I'm not sure. I'm just going to take a guess and think. I think that one's in Paris. Isn't that one, like, near the bridge where she got killed?
That's right. You're right. Yeah.
But this one is in Hyde Park, and it's sort of a ovoid, sort of big, like, you know, quite 20 meters wide, sort of circular waterway. And water just goes up and down and around this very stylized, strange water fountain, really. And that's this memorial to her. I don't know when it was put up. I just randomly walked into it. I wasn't planning to.
Sure.
But I suppose you could add your David Icke sort of conspiracy there, because it's right overlooking the Serpentine River. Wow. So you have your your reptilian serpent cult putting their memorial to their victim right there.
Yeah, exactly. Sheesh, oh my God. Yeah, they do continue.
If you want to look at it that way.
If you want to look at it that way.
There's other ways to look at it as well.
That's right. Okay, yeah, very nice. Yeah, very nice. Interesting to hear about that. Are you going to... is it something you're going to continue working on, or going to put something together by it, or is this more lying in the backwaters and pick it up when it arrives, or what? Any plans on this?
I am probably going to make a crop circle video or two, probably soon. It's probably what I'm going to start doing any day now. I'm actually researching crop circles as we speak, but sort of from the synchromistic angle. I've sort of gone to the fields now and gotten a feel for it. And fascinating, and there's many others that we saw as well. But the one that I'm really interested in is the doors of perception, the 3D glyph, the sort of the famous one of this season. Mm-hmm. You know which one I mean?
Isn't that the one with the checkerboard and like a
That's
passage?
Right.
Yeah,
the
exactly.
Checkerboard and the doors and the sort of receding hallway.
Sure.
That's the one that I think is really fascinating that happened this year. Unfortunately, it was cut out when we had come there. The farmers in the Silbury area cut out the circles right after they happened to dissuade people from, you know, stomping around their fields, which is very sad.
Sure.
Yeah,
that's interesting. So
I've been watching Signs and all the other movies and popular culture references that I can get my hand on, looking for patterns and synchronicities involving crop circles, and then I'll put that in with my own sort of more forensic ideas about particularly that West Kennet, you know, doors of perception is what I'm calling it, crop circle.
That's good. Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing that one. Excellent. Yeah, hope things go well with that one. You know, hey, by the way, I also want to commend you on your most recent video, and it was very nice to hear a portion of that interview with Joseph Farrell that we did on SS Brother of the Bell. You got some really nice connections going there with a combination of the Nazi Bell, the Hive, the Bus, and the Octagons and all that, you know.
Yes. It was very interesting. I mean, the using the footage from the movie Chicken Little with it is just peculiar. I mean, I don't know why that movie keeps coming up, and I just accidentally, you know, sort of started watching it because, you know, Greg actually from A Cult of Personality had told me that there were a lot of octagons and stuff like that in there. I had a look at it, and it just keeps coming up because there's even crop circles in that movie. So.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I mean, it's very, it is very weird and very scary actually for a, you know, for a being a kids movie. some very mystical elements to it. That's right. Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, and again, that movie will, you know, sort of make you debate about, you know, are these symbols and images and themes going through these movies as some sort of Disney plot to influence the minds of the young kids, or is it just a coincidence, synchronicity, or, you know.
Yeah.
But for me, I'm beyond caring about that. I don't try and figure out why symbols are there or why synchronicities are there. I just follow them and they guide me almost in a way. I just follow them and I don't really care why they're there. I just
yeah. I mean, if there were some way that we could actually make sure and like come into the planning meetings of how this comes about on one of these movies and actually see that, of course, would be very interesting and see what these people are, you know, what they know and so forth. But I actually agree with you at one point there. It doesn't matter because it's there and it's, you know, there, even if it's, you know, conscious or unconscious, and we can make of that what we will, basically.
Yeah, it's sort of, you know, it's almost like there's a higher function of our minds that are evolving where these contradictions and sort of questions about why these things are happening or how they're happening will just become null and void. They won't have any meaning anymore. This happens a lot when you read Goro Adachi's work. You know, he's like, he's just using anything, you know, he calls it multi-contextual, which is his word for synchromysticism, really. And it explains it in another interesting way, multi-contextual, just using any material, anything as your way of investigating, you know. The weather, the current events, popular culture, anything. And, you know, he does great work by sort of showing these patterns in there. And I do believe that you also see the personality and the ego of the person who is doing that. You will, like, if you see my work, you will see my Egyptian bias and my 9/11 bias going through it. And if you see Goro's work, you'll see his astrological bias and his whatever bias, you know, going through the work, and you'll see the person's personality. But hopefully we are plotting, you know, patterns that are there.
That's right.
And that you can draw your own conclusion from.
That's right. And there's no laid out rules on how this can be done, of course. So, you know, we can go with anything here. Anything goes. That's the beauty of this, you know.
I think it's actually, you know, I obviously I like my work because I'm doing it, and I think it's worth doing, so I bother doing it. But I think it's a new way of looking at the world, and I think it'll be an important tool as things progress. I mean, a lot of people are going to think it's noise, and that's fine. But I think it's actually a very novel way of looking at the world and a very powerful technique.
Well,
all you need is your intuition and your belief, and you just go. It's great.
Exactly, and in a way, I think it actually is an implementation of the idea of the holographic universe, because you know, you can see in every part there is a piece of the whole, and vice versa, and so forth. You know, it's something that loops back on itself, and you can pick up anything again, anything goes in a holographic universe, And this kind of spawns on that idea, I guess, and takes it a bit further and actually makes something of it that we can see in our, you know, day-to-day life, basically.
Yeah, it acknowledges basically, you know, the Tao, the fact that you are drawing conclusions from anything.
Mm.
It's sort of acknowledging that anything is important and everything is connected, and therefore it's better, in my mind, you know, I'm sure a lot of people would disagree, it's better than a sort of forensic investigation or just a clinical, you know, empirical, using your, you know, whatever you can see with your senses type thing, because that ignores all the mystical, all the magical, and that, in a sense, is all really there is. And, you know, there's this constant, you know, feeling that everything loops back on itself. You were mentioning this a little earlier, where it's like, if you really sit down at any given point and you take any idea as far as it can go, you usually end up, you know, looping back wherever you are, you know. And there's this mysterious force or this now moment that we're sort of in. And I think synchromysticism and this multi-contextual thought process is acknowledging this sort of loopy logic that people are trying to hide from, but I think it's gonna bite you. So
and I also think, actually, and you mentioned forensic work in that way, but speaking of, you know, like, take a criminal investigator, for instance, or something like that, a detective, I think many of those guys actually would tell you that intuition is a big part of their work and ability to solve cases, and the importance, of course, of the hunch, or, you know, the gut feeling, you know.
I agree. Yeah, definitely. And I don't think that kind of stuff doesn't have its place. I mean, you wouldn't want to, you know, I wouldn't want somebody to try and solve my mother's murder with synchromysticism as a first as the first step, you know. Maybe let's look at the evidence, the cold hard facts first, and then if we can't get anything there, then maybe we'll move on to synchromysticism.
Sure, but it's a tool like everything else, in a way.
It's and you have to know what's the best time for the best tool, you know. Like, what tool is going to have the best results in the given moment? So
that's right.
Yeah, it's not a cure-all, and it's just what I'm into at the moment. So
that's right. You also had some lost material in your latest piece, and that was very, very nice to see that you picked up on some of that stuff. You know, very good to see that and getting into it. Have you been watching a lot of Lost since the past months or something like that, or?
Yeah, and well, I finished all the Lost up to where the series is at right now, and I find it's a very interesting show. It's really mysterious to have something that's actually good and interesting be like one of the most popular shows on TV.
Yeah,
maybe you could see that as a positive sign, and I think I do. But I mean, it's not brilliant. It's an interesting show. But full, replete of mystery and intrigue and symbolism and all the stuff that connects to my work. And you and Frederick were partly responsible for some of the ideas that I had surrounding Lost, and particular episode Enter 77.
That's right. Yeah,
because this number keeps coming up. This, you know, 77 number.
Yeah.
For me, as connected to Oz and Oz being one of Crowley's sigils and symbols, and that was relevant and connected to Pan. And Pan, I find, connected to 9/11 and the Kaaba because of the movie. The Wiz has the words Oz right on the Kaaba, which actually the sphere. I get confused because they're both interchangeable in my mind. But the sphere is a representation of the Kaaba. The sphere was this sculpture at the World Trade Center complex, if people don't know what the hell I'm talking about.
That was fascinating, and we talked about that just a little bit before we began the show here, that there is, speaking about Lost here, of course, that there is tremendous detail going into this series. There is a site out there, Lostpedia or something like that actually details a lot of this stuff, and you can get a lot of interesting info from there.
There's more than one of those sites. There's like a few Lostopedias and Lost Wiki and Lost. I don't know. It's crazy.
Mm, yeah.
It's really amazing.
The word puzzles and exactly. And we kind of stuck to that episode also, Enter 77, for many different reasons. But I mean, there were so much in there, and you can find connections everywhere. As you know, once you begin look, I guess you can find it in many of those episodes. But it was something with that episode that kind of stuck out when me and Fredrik first saw it. So interesting to see some of that material cycled in your video. So that's great.
Yeah, I was curious to see what would be the reaction if I use something as popular as Lost as a sort of synchromistic tool. And I don't really think it's sort of increased the amount of people who watch those videos. I think it's still sort of too fringe. So it doesn't matter really if I use anything that's mega popular. It doesn't mean you're going to get more interest.
They're going to get around, you know, when weird stuff is going to begin to happen, you know, they're going to...
Yes. It's imminent, definitely.
Yeah, exactly. One thing I did wanted to run by you here, because I don't know if you know this yet or nothing, but considering your latest stuff on Oz and 7-7 and connecting with Crowley and New York and World Trade Center and all of that, I linked up recently a video among the quick links on Red Eyes that was about the blackout in New York City in 1977. It was a short clip up on the site. I can link that up in case people want to see it. This was from a documentary about the music industry, I think. But it was a connection here with what they refer to this as NYC 77, and there were apparently tremendous heat waves that summer in New York, or I guess around the United States. But so there's a little bit of resonance there, I think, with the live Earth 77 thing, but. There was one other interesting thing also, but because this was also referred to as the summer of Son of Sam. This is the guy who's known as David Berkowitz. I don't know if you know who that is, as a serial killer.
Yeah, I saw the Spike Lee movie. that much I remember.
Is it called Son of Sam, the Spike Lee movie? Or?
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't seen that one. I gotta check that out. Okay, that's interesting. Because he was behind... I think he killed actually six people at that time, and the summer was kind of referred to as the son of Sam summer, and this was in 77. And there is a little bit of a connection, I guess, with Crowley. He was very much into the occult, of course, and you know, I don't know if it's a satanic connection in a way there, but there was some resonating stuff with Crowley, because he wrote actually a letter that Rupert Murdoch's New York Post published. I don't know if that was the same summer or the summer after. Anyway, there was some line in there from David Berkowitz that read that he was the monster, or I am the monster Beelzebub, the shabby behemoth, and stuff like this, you know.
And Beelzebub is definitely connected to the World Trade Center, in my mind at least. This hasn't come up yet on the videos, but... Mm-hmm. Beelzebub is totally connected to Baal and Baal.
Yeah.
So, Beelzebub is obviously often portrayed as a bee. If you go to Wikipedia and you check up Beelzebub, last time I did, you know, it's always evolving and changing, but it was this bee demon thing, and the bee, it just keeps coming up like crazy.
Yeah.
And also, you know, Baal and Baal, they're like the spider. So then you have the spider and the bee, which are almost interchangeable with Baal and Baal. And the spider keeps coming up with World Trade Center as well, synchromistically, if you think about Spider-Man and maybe the commercial, the teaser trailer where he makes the web in between the two towers.
Yeah.
And captures the helicopter, which is another theme that I've been exploring lately, the helicopter.
Yeah.
And
you
got the spider, which keeps coming up. Also in Alan Moore's Promethea, he has this ball going to the Tower 7 building in there, which I've connected to World Trade Center, obviously, through, you know, Tower 7 and So it's a big complex web of stuff that probably sounds like noise when you're just talking about it. But if you go watch the videos and the follow the words with the images, it'll probably make a whole lot more sense.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But no, I totally agree with you that their connection with the bee and the beehive. And I think Jeff Wells of Rigorous Intuition wrote a few pieces about this way back.
Yes. You sent me that link. It was very good. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, there's just something to it. I don't know what, but there it is. And I'm thinking about the bee and the beehive, obviously the hexagon comes up.
That's right. Yeah.
But
it's something to do with the pyramids. I don't know how exactly to explain, but if you look at Masonic imagery, you often see the beehive right next to the pyramids, like on their aprons, other places. And, you know, they're one of the symbols of Masonry is a beehive. They're like the worker bees, and it's brotherhood, and, you know, they're all like the bee. So there's this connection between the beehive and its tiers going up. You know, it sort of like has the big fat concentric circles going all the way up to the top. That idea and sort of this conic shape connecting to the ben and the pyramid is sort of like a beehive, is sort of like the pyramid. You know, I keep connecting the World Trade Center to the pyramids of Giza. There's many reasons for that.
And
I really think it's significant that if you research the World Trade Center synchronistically, the bee keeps coming up. And if you look at the pyramids of Giza, the bee comes up through Masonry. And I don't know, there's some very speculative ideas I have about the pyramids and the sort of like being a beehive, you know, like maybe in the ancient times, this was like one of the things we built just before our consciousness changed, and we sort of had this hive mind mentality, and as worker bees, you know, sort of one mind, you know, like an ant can build this sort of heel shaped thing with all these complex structures inside, and yet it has no centralized mind. And the bee as well builds this complex hexagonal geometry thing, you know, the bee hive. And how did we build the pyramids? Like, maybe we had a different kind of mind back there, where we had a more insect-like mind. And so I play with these ideas.
That is so fascinating. I've been playing around actually with that idea myself also, that this has to do with a consciousness that is different in some way. And even because even the art of the, if you look at some of the stuff that happens in nature, you can see that the sacred geometry is there, the perfection of stuff is there. But as soon as we nowadays, okay, as you say, masonry and architecture and all this is an effort to replicate that to a certain degree. But when you look at it through the eyes of nature, perfection is there. And I mean, people are saying that we couldn't build the pyramid today, even if we tried, you know. And this just shows you that some other mind, some other kind of consciousness must be there. And I'm leaning towards this way also. This going back to the queen, you know, of the hive.
That's right.
All of this. Yeah, that's fascinating. Wow.
Yeah, it's something to do with, you know, how, I don't know, this is very speculative stuff. So, you know, take it in that mind frame. But it's sort of like, you know, when a bee moves from area to area, you know, the queen will go and look, scope out the new terrain, you know, roughly. I don't study insects, but the queen goes and studies, finds the new suitable terrain, and then sets up shop, and then the beehive forms around that, you know. And maybe that's sort of this interplanetary thing where the first thing you kind of build is your pyramid, you know, and that's why it's like this oldest structure on the planet. It's sort of this consciousness or something that came from space and then built this thing, this thing which we're still sort of gawking at and wondering what the fuck is it, because we don't really know. Nobody who says they know knows, because we don't know what that thing is. And
that's right.
Partly one of my bones to pick with the Masons is this sort of claim that they did build the pyramids, or that they were involved in some way, because prove it, like, how did you build that thing? And if you did, that sort of puts this unconscious thread in people's minds, that these people sort of have the right to, you know, be as powerful and influential as they are, because they're connected to this infinitely mysterious monument that could be everybody's heritage, you know, not just, you know, the Masons that built it or involved. Like, it sort of seems like, you know, if they had something to do with the pyramids, you know, they have to explain it better to me, because I just don't like to buy it. It seems to give them too much power.
Yeah, that's right. And in a way, how the heck can we forget? I mean, there is a disconnection here. I mean, we hear this again and again, that ancient people are leaving sites, you know, leaving buildings and leaving pyramids and ancient cities and stuff like that, leaving them behind for some reason. And then there is the a time when these kind of nature takes over and they are covered by, you know, earth or, you know, sand or whatever it might be. And then we return to these sites, uncover them again. But, I mean, there's, as you said, there, this is very weird that there is this kind of disconnection. How the heck can we forget if we built such a thing? And new people all the time now, of course, come to these subjects and trying to prove how it's done. And new money is being put into making new documentaries about how they built the pyramids and all this. So obviously, this is not solved, you know, yet by far, you know.
No, it's not. It's not. I mean, it's I don't know. It's one of the most interesting things out there, is the pyramids, as far as I'm concerned, because, you know, it's the, it just doesn't make sense. That it's been said a million times and probably will be said a million times yet. Maybe we will get to the bottom of it soon. Maybe that's part of what the dawning of the new consciousness is like figuring out the origins. And that seems to involve the pyramids. Like, if you go back to all the sort of myths and histories, you have the sacred mountain, or you have the mound of Atum coming out of the chaos of the waters. And I think that's the pyramid. Maybe at one point the thing was submerged in water and you had to like row up to it, you know, with a boat. And then you had your Atlantean mountain sticking out of the water or something like that. Yeah. I think it's very old. And I don't think anybody around now can claim to have built it, or have a maybe you have a connection to somebody who built it, but you need to put that out there, you know, in a better way than just sort of saying that you do, because you have it on your apron or something. It just doesn't. I don't see how that's possible. And
they're,
you know, I do respect the Masons and all that, but this, I mean, and not all of them obviously think that they are directly connected to the pyramid builders, but it is something that is floated there unconsciously, even consciously. So
they're to some degree, I guess, taking credit for it. But the question if it's if that's the case here. But
And I think it's an important psychological thing to know, you know, or to have a good healthy model for where your first piece of architecture comes from and why it's one of the most complex structures, millimeter perfect, you know. It doesn't make sense, you know, it doesn't make sense. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, I'm interested in these subjects. It's always been the pyramids, you know, like, why do you have this infinitely mysterious thing that's one of the oldest things, could be the oldest thing, like, man-made structure out there? I don't know, you know, it's just a peculiar anomaly, completely, like, out of context structure, just standing there.
Yeah. Exactly, and what you talked about, the water, the site Teotihuacan in Mexico, I think there was in Graham Hancock's, what was that documentary called? I'm forgetting it now, but the main that he did, Graham Hancock, the three-part, excellent one, he actually talked with a researcher in there that actually speculated that the entire area where the pyramid structure or complex of those many pyramids over there is, that that was filled with water also. So that is definitely an idea that, that keeps kind of returning to it. And I think it was David Sarita that speculated about also the fact that it might have been water throughout the entire Giza Plateau, you know, so you had a boat there or something, you know, to get around.
I seriously think that there is some water connection, you know, whether it's metaphorical or physical, you know, we don't really know. I don't know how people claim to know any of these things. It's just preposterous. But yeah, there's much patterns and themes and synchronicities you can follow that get you to, I don't know, the pyramids play a central role in the narrative of Atlantis, in our ancient history. Everything. It all seems to be centered around Giza, you know, and then you have these other interesting pyramids all around the world too, but they're all somehow connected to Giza. And
yeah,
I don't think we've cracked it, because I think it seems like, you know, when you really get to the bottom of something, it's that aha moment where you're like, you know, oh, okay, it was so simple. All the parts were there, and now we've just put it together in the right way. And it's like, oh, of course, how could we not have seen it?
Yeah.
That's when you know you've got the answer.
Yeah.
Not like sort of a complex astrological thing that, you know, two people can understand. No, it's usually simple and elegant and aha, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
That's usually, so I'm waiting for that with the pyramids, and maybe it's coming, I don't know.
Yeah, we'll see. They're gonna continue. I don't know why nothing is happening, because I'm not hearing anything at the moment on that front, but they are going to continue exploring, you know, the shafts that they were, they sent a robot, a little robot up there a while back. And found, of course, another door.
I remember that. It was great.
Yeah, caption behind there. So I think they're going to hopefully soon drill through that and see what happens or what might reveal itself behind there, you know.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what they find. And, you know, then it'll all start again with can we believe them? You know, who are they in any way? And
exactly,
why
did
they tell us what's happening in the pyramids? Why don't we have our own representatives? You know, whatever. It's just
it's an ongoing thing.
Ongoing thing, and yeah, and but there's interesting connections between that Westconnet long barrow, three-dimensional receding hallway door, checkerboard glyph, and the pyramids. Obviously, I feel at least, and I will be exploring this in the videos. But it's got to do with, you know, the checkerboard being the first degree tracing board, and the first degree tracing board being a map of Giza, you know, with the three pillars being the three pyramids of Giza. And then there are also, obviously, because I believe that the World Trade Center are the same pillars on the first degree tracing board, the pillars of Solomon's Temple, which are also modeled after Giza.
Yeah.
So you have this first degree tracing board representation now in the crop circles with this receding hallway, which people have mentioned look like the Valley Temple, which is right there at Giza, and also the Osirian, which is at Abydos, you know, where the helicopter glyph is, you know. And so you have this all coming together in this crop circle. And it was that crop circle that led me to investigate the helicopter and get this sort of, I shudder to say, time travel theory about 9/11 and its related subjects. So this very interesting crop circle that I will be hopefully exploring in more detail. And it's got Mal Gibson, and because that crop circle also looks like the painting, the First Supper, you know?
Yeah. The Last Supper, or
who painted that? I'm drawing a blank here. Is it Leonardo?
Yeah,
right?
Da Vinci. The Last Supper.
Da Vinci. Right. Yeah,
of course. Yeah.
I've investigated that painting before, and you know, Jesus looks like a triangular figure in there, and you have Mary Magdalene right next to him, and it has that same receding hallway with the windows looking much like those doors that we see in that crop circle.
That's interesting. Yeah.
It's on the crop circle connector. Somebody has seen this before, but it's an interesting connection between these subjects, because it all goes back, obviously, to the pyramids, because, you know, Jesus was your last pharaoh of Egypt, if you follow your Ralph Ellis, which I tend to. And then, then you have the checkerboard is, again, the floor of the Great Pyramid with its limes or basalt and, you know, stone, white, black pattern. There's much to investigate there, and you can connect it all back to 9/11 as well, unfortunately, because it starts sounding crazy when I say that kind of thing. But there you go.
Oh, that's going to be great to see that. Yeah, definitely. Continue that. Yeah. Keep that up. Yeah, that's fascinating. You know, I just wanted to run this by also and ask you a little bit about comic books, because this is something that you've been referring to at least lately in your videos.
Yes.
You included in your title, of course, comic book cycle. So I mean, are you a big comic book buff, or what's going on here?
Well, I used to read a lot of comics growing up. You know, as a kid, I was fascinated by superheroes. I still like some of that stuff, but I do love comic books. But more like nowadays, you know, the Alan Moore type graphic novel. You know, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and you know, that kind of stuff. Promethea, Moore stuff is great. Grant Morrison has some great stuff. You know, there's Neil Gaiman, Sandman, that stuff. You know, there's some really great stuff that you can get in comic book form. So it's really great.
Is this like very tidy research, or is it? I mean, I'm thinking about how you find all the stuff in the comics book, or maybe it's filled with this stuff.
When,
I don't know.
When it comes to the World Trade Center connections in the comic books, that was just doing online research. I didn't know about those because of my comic book background. I suppose I had some sort of, I could put it into context because of my comic book background, because I do know the superheroes roughly, you know, the Fantastic Four and all those people. I suppose it would be difficult if you didn't have some superhero background to put it into any kind of context. But no, I mean, if you research on the internet is just amazing nowadays. It's ripped everything up into little segments. You know, you type in a word and it'll give you the relevant bit of a book. It'll give you the relevant bit of a comic book. It'll give you the relevant bit of Wikipedia that has a reference to whatever it's ripped. It's putting everything into this insane web of context, you know, and you can just go and rip everything out of its context and get, so it's perfect for synchromysticism. It wouldn't be possible without the internet to do what I do, because you just type in World Trade Center comic books and, you know, you'll find there quite a few. And then there's also a few that sort of magically just seem to come out of the void when you're researching and you get really into it. It's like they just sort of flow towards you. It's like there's no resistance, so that you just accidentally or coincidentally are at the right place at the right time. So you'll watch the right movie accident. You know, there's magic involved as well.
That's right. Yeah.
I just wanted to complete a thought that I remembered that I dropped when I was talking about Mel Gibson and the crop circle that looks like The Last Supper. Mel Gibson directs The Passion of Christ, right?
Yeah.
And in there you have The Last Supper happening, you know. So he's directed this famous event. And he's also the most, like, crop circle resonant person in the popular culture because of the Signs movie, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right, of course, yeah.
So you have him directing this very famous, controversial Passion of the Christ movie, which has The Last Supper in it. You have him in the Signs movie. And then even weirder, there's a Futurama episode called That's Lobstertainment. And, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Futurama. They will all start with like a little subtitle at the bottom, some sort of funny subtitle. And that particular episode, That's Lobstertainment, which is from 2001, I think. You know, it's before Signs, whenever it was, says decoded from crop circles.
Oh, really?
So The entire episode, according to that subtitle, is decoded from crop circles. Oh. And then in that episode, they have an incident with his head,
Mel Gibson's head.
So you have all these synchronicities pointing towards Mel Gibson and crop circles. And you know, I'll be trying to put that all into some sort of context that doesn't make me sound like a raving loon in the video, but it probably won't work. If you look at the comments on YouTube for my videos, it probably won't work. They'll still say you're a raving loon, but that's okay.
I mean, I love it. I think it's, you know, fantastic. And one thing I like too is that Futurama and also, of course, The Simpsons come up frequently in your work, and it feels also because of the nature of both those shows. I mean, they use a lot of references to other previous stories. It's almost like they are working themselves with those kind of archetypal stories in a way. I mean, many of the episodes are you know, very traditional storytelling in a way, or they talk about other movies or make parody of those and back and forth. But I mean, Matt Groening, the guy who develops that, do you think it feels like he's, I mean, he doesn't write everything, of course, these days.
No.
There's a lot of other writers who do that, but And Simpsons have, I guess, what I think at least, have kind of dropped in quality a little bit, but...
Yes, no doubt.
I mean, after 18 seasons, or what is it, 19, what can you do, you know?
No, I mean, it's really incredible, incredible show, and it's just how it's impacted culture. I mean, all this stuff has been said, but it's fascinating just how, you know, something can become so part of pop culture that it is pop culture. You know, it's like,
yeah,
it starts parodying itself. It starts,
yeah, exactly.
You know, it starts making fun of Simpsons just to be funny. And it's just, it's a great place to look for synchronicities because it's so huge and because they just go everywhere. And and it is, you know, it's an intelligent show. It has lots of material worth looking at. And it helps when the synchronicities are in shows that are actually worth watching, because otherwise you end up watching some horrible stuff. I was watching Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle 2 days ago because there's a crop circle in there. So I have to watch a lot of bad stuff as well.
Yeah.
But, so I don't know.
Yeah. And by the way, about Simpsons and similar shows, it could be that because of it, that it reaches a lot of people, the Overmind, I guess we could call it again here, is using some way that show to actually get a point across or to speak to people in more subtle nuances. I don't know, that's a potential thread that I've been pondering upon why there's stuff
definitely
coming up, you know.
Yeah, and that's sort of the entire point of synchromysticism, and I would say, not to speak for Goro, but that's how I view his work as well, is the sort of patterns in everything. But because we are familiar with pop culture and because our society is at the moment, you know, all about materialism and, you know, movies and all these things, all this sort of media, We need to look into the media to discover the sacred and the divine, because that's where everybody's looking. So if we're not going to find it in there, we're never going to find it again, or, you know, we will. But but this is one of the doors, is by showing the sacred and the mystery and the profound in this media, which to a large extent has become very empty and, you know, a tool of conformity and all this sort of negative stuff. There's also great shows like The Simpsons, etc. But if you can show how in Lost and in The Simpsons and in Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle there are all these mystical hints towards this overmind, I think you got something there. I think you got something there worthwhile. And that's what I'm part of, and I really enjoy it. And
nice.
I'm glad people have been responding to it, and it's been... keeps growing, keeps getting more interesting, and
it keeps growing. I guess also at this point you receive a lot of tips from other folks who keep up with your work, and a lot of research ideas from them, maybe.
And there's a whole community of bloggers that have sort of developed, you know, with their own takes on things, but everybody's sort of connected up together because of the magic of the internet. You know, you'll pick up threads from each other. You know, you'll pick up something from Ben Farrell or from Todd Campbell or from A Ferris Moon, and they'll pick up something from you, and you'll, you know, sort of cross-check each other and give interesting ideas. And then just everybody who reads the stuff can comment on the pieces and stuff like that. So, it's it wouldn't really be possible without this network and without the internet and the technology. Everything is the way it is because of the way everything is right now.
And that's right.
It's just really fascinating stuff that's happening, and
it's growing, and it's taking a life on its own, as it were. That's nice. Listen, Jake, I think that this is a great place to begin to round things up for this time, but again I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's always a pleasure to have you on and speaking about your work and your ideas and all of that. And I'm looking forward, of course, very much to the next video out there. But as always, I want to leave the last few minutes to you and tell people that aren't familiar with your work or about your site, and also, of course, about your beautiful prints that you have out there for people, or t-shirts that, that people can get if they want to support your work?
Yeah, you, people want to find out about the work, get your head into this mess, then you just go to thebravenewworldorder.blogspot.com, and you can get links to everything from there. Nowadays, everything's sort of moved to YouTube because I'm making videos, and I've had more hits on my videos than I've had on my blog, because YouTube is just this, you know, crazy, massively connected mind of its own, and the videos on YouTube have had more hits collectively than my blog has had individually. So so there's a lot of people who don't even know that I have a blog, or that or even know who I am. They just watch the videos on YouTube when they come out. And so if you just go to YouTube, my nickname is Seal Lion, S-E-A-L-L-I-O-N, or just go to the blog and you can get links there to everything. And it's as simple as that. There's links to my artworks and other activities that I've been involved in, and
Yeah, again, thank you so much for coming on, Jake, and as I said, it's a pleasure to have you on, and looking forward to speaking with you again soon.
Yes, thank you very much, Henrik. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.